The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk New York. I'm WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here. I'm taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 13th day of June, 2021. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us as always, taking care of business. Got a busy show for you guys tonight. Up first, we'll talk tennis with the great Andrea Yeager. Following Andrea, we'll welcome in the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. That's in Kansas City, Missouri. Bob Kendrick will come in. But last but not least, we'll talk to former New York Yankees trainer and now author, Jeff Mangold. He's got a new book. It's called Power and Pinstripes, My Years Training the New York Yankees. So sit back, relax, get comfortable. Some great sports chat coming up to you this evening. As always, before I begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page. So much information there. You'll enjoy it, I promise. So give us a look, then give us a like. You can also follow us on LinkedIn and on Twitter at WGBB Sports Talk. And you can follow me on Twitter at BDonahueWGBB. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're all archived on our website, and you can listen to them at your leisure. Well, our first guest, a highly successful tennis career ended prematurely due to shoulder injuries. She reached the singles final of Wimbledon in 1983 and the French Open in 1982. She reached the singles semifinals of the Australian Open in 1982 and won the French Open with Jimmy Arias in mixed doubles. After retirement, she's prominently dedicated her life to the service of others, no pun intended there. Please welcome to the show tonight, Andrea Yeager. Andrea, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you with us. I apologize for my voice. I had a little issue today, and I'm doing the best I can. So just bear with me.
You're screaming during the French.
Yeah. Now, who were your sports heroes as a kid, Andrea? What happened? Andrea, you with us?
Yes.
Okay. Did you hear my question?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
We're in Oakland Raiders jackets always.
Ah.
Silver jacket as a kid. But then I also had a Miami Dolphins hat. Winter hat.
Yeah. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Sports was an Olympic kind of part of the time growing.
Okay, that's great. Now, in 1980, you became the youngest player ever to be seeded at Wimbledon. Now, that record was broken by Jennifer Capriati in 1990. I remember I finally made it to Wimbledon in 1982. And I queued to get onto center court. I saw Jimmy Connors play somebody there. I saw you warming up on one of the outside courts. Now, tell us a little bit about the atmosphere at Wimbledon versus Roland Garros and the U.S. Open in Flushing.
Each Grand Slam has a distinct characteristic.
Sure.
I mean, they have almost like a personality. And the French Open, obviously, with the red clay, a lot of players, you know, you could see this great fights. I mean, it was just, you basically gutted out points, and you could, you know, do a lot of fitness over and over and hopefully come out as a successor there. Wimbledon's completely different. When I played, the grass was much faster.
Oh,
it was a different type of grass. Now the grass, the balls, sometimes they bounce a little higher, so it can, and they make the balls different. Sometimes they let some air out, sometimes they could really affect the game that way. But Wimbledon has a mistake about it. It's the history. It's the all-white. It's the...
Right.
It's just a classic atmosphere. The fans are a little bit more reserved. You get to the U.S. Open, and you can smell the hot dog vendors and the hamburger vendors and the electric crowd. I mean, the crowd is just something spectacular. And once you land in New York City, if you're not used to hearing, like, city noise, it almost elevates you to a different level of tennis, because you feel electric because of the energy of the city and of the crowd. So each, you know, and the Australian Open obviously has its own distinct personality as well. But the French Open was something pretty spectacular, and now Wimbledon's very quick, and the schedule is coming up in just a couple weeks, and then the Olympics are right after.
Yep, and I have a photo of you. I found it the other day, but it's from one of those 110 pocket cameras that Kodak came out with, and not too many pixels in those things back then, so it's kind of blurry. But you defeated Chris Everett in a semifinal at the French, but you lost the final to Martina. Tell us a little bit about playing with those two women.
I played in a very exciting era. My era was Chris Everett, Martina Navratilova, Billie Jean. I mean, those two women helped make women's sports. Tracy Austin, of course, and Pam Sleder did, and other players that were in my era were part of making women's sports what it is today. And it was, in a sense, for me, I turned pro at 14, and I was two in the world at 16. So you're in that atmosphere of, you know, something incredible is happening in sports. And I watched those players growing up on TV, but not so much. I was more about the, like, wide world of sports and Olympic sports. Mm-hmm. And when I went to go play against Chris or Martina or Billie Jean, I wasn't intimidated. I didn't feel as if they were better in a sense, even when I was a kid. And so when I played Chris a few times and then lost those and then eventually beat her my first time on hard court, then on clay, and then again on clay, but that time was the Roland Garros clay. And it was, for me, one of the easiest matches I played at the Open. I just played really well. I played so well I had to actually go back out and practice. I knew my background could be a different opponent and a better opponent in that sense. But, you know, when you play against legends like that, you only really recognize the significance of it possibly like decades later, even years later. And now I look back and go, wow, you know, I'm one of the few people that have ever beaten Chris and Martina and Billie Jean King and, during my career. That's pretty special.
That is. What a great perspective to look at it that way, Andrea. Definitely. Those women, Chris Everett, Martina Navratilova, Billie Jean King, all idols and all legends in tennis. Is there anyone who maybe took you under their wing? I mean, you were just a kid, like you said. Did anybody take you under their wing and say, listen, let me show you the ropes or anything like that?
No. I think individual sports are very different. I believe Olympic sports that are individual, that might happen more frequently because you're on a team. You're representing your country. It didn't happen in sport at that time, and I don't know if it, you know, now I'm sure it's very different. There's friendships that are made on the circuit because people can separate it. Back then, very different atmosphere.
Okay.
The last place I ever wanted to be in was a locker room during my tournaments, whether there was a Grand Slam or not. And I mean, there's times I've changed in portalettes in a lot. I just haven't spent a lot of time changing in portalettes. What's really the atmosphere of, gosh, I actually thought it was going to be very different when I got on the circuit, but it's such as a life when the sport is trying to become its own and it's an individual sport. It just was a different era.
Yes, that it was. We're speaking with Andrea Jaeger tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, even when you were on the tour, you took time out to visit hospitals, and you decided then early that you wanted to make a vocation out of helping people, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I felt so grateful just to be traveling the world, and I love tennis, but I thought, wow, we have this opportunity. Why not help others, like help kids on the street corners and in hospitals and schools? And that was part of my excitement as much as playing center court Wimbledon or, you know, getting to the U.S. Open and being able to play on those hard courts or playing. One of my favorite places to play at was Madison Square Garden as well. I mean, that was something I'd watched all kinds of sports happen. And so to be able to give back to those communities was something that was just as much as my love as tennis was.
Now, I found somewhere, Andrea, that you said you were never really committed to being the top-ranked player in the world, and sometimes you even tanked matches to avoid the top ranking. Is that true?
You know, I don't know if we have a long enough broadcast to explain this whole thing, but, you know, there were situations. I was a teenager on the circuit, and there was circumstances that I didn't necessarily feel comfortable with, and I tried to be honorable, and sometimes in my teenage exuberance to be honorable, it ended up that I felt better if I lost a match than if I won it. And there was a lot of different circumstances, you know, that ended up being a case. I mean, just, oh gosh, there's so many. But, like, for example, at the French Open, after the Christmas, I was playing. And my dad and I would have thought the whole crowd as well, but I noticed that Martina's coach was coaching her during the match. And we know that this isn't allowed because, like, U.S. Open, we saw that with Serena Williams.
Right, yeah.
Coaching. So my dad was getting very upset because the tour and the referees and nobody was stopping Martina's coach and from doing this. And I felt so uncomfortable because it was just like this energy. Because like at that point they were sitting next to each other. Now like the U.S. Open, they're on different sides of the stadium and with players. That one wasn't the case, and it made me very uncomfortable because I knew coaching was cheating, and it was so obvious that I didn't know. I mean, I could see the coach doing it. That I was like, okay, if I see what she's doing and I notice it, am I cheating by following what she's doing? Because if she tells Martina like to drop shot, and I knew it, it was so confusing because I was a teenager and I had this moral code that to me cheating was just horrible. It was just before God. God would see it, and so for me, it was just a horrible thing that I would never want to ever do. And so I felt like nobody was stopping it. Nobody was stopping the coach. Well, the coach happened to be Renee Richards, who, had a history coming on the street. I knew, Dr. Richards and Renee Richards and never had a problem. I mean, I played against her when she was on the circuit. I, never had a problem with her playing or anything, but she's now doing this coaching and I just felt so bad for my dad because it was like, what is the headline that my dad screamed out at somebody,
It's like,
I just felt so uncomfortable that I thought, okay, I can stop coaching. Renee will stop coaching Martina. And then everybody will be fine. My dad left this down and, I'm like, but this is better than my dad having the headline of getting in a fight with the woman. So that was like a moral thing for me that I just felt was a better way to have a result. Who wants a fight in the stands? Who wants a French Open final? And so I just, laid off on the strokes I could hit really well. And, and Martina won. No one said anything. No one asked about anything after. And it, went away quietly. And so I don't think anyone said there's plenty of others that are out there. But that to me it's trying to solve a problem that a teenager had with having a moral compass that I had and not having a lot of problems solving, techniques at my disposal. Ideally I would have rather had someone say, hey, Renee, net coaching's allowed, stop it, or we'll have to remove you, or we'll have to penalize Martina. Nobody did it. So a fight was going to happen and I didn't want my father to be the person that was looked upon as a bad person when he was just trying to stop something.
Understood. Andrea Yeager with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Let's talk about the Little Star Foundation, Andrea. Let's get to the important stuff. Tell us about your foundation.
Well, we're now on our 36 years.
Wow.
It's been pretty amazing. Yeah, with all my money that I earned from tennis, I decided I wanted to help children with cancer and children in need and provide them long-term care. And so just have been devoting my life. We provide financial assistance programs, camp programs, scholarship opportunities, educational opportunities. And so we've been improving the quality of life and providing long-term care to these children all across the U.S. and worldwide. And we're on our 36th year. So it's probably something I'm most proud about. You see a lot of players out there in the world that have an opportunity to, go further than their sport. And I know your next guest, I think, is, you mentioned Bob Kendrick.
Yes.
And baseball. And I won the Jackie Robinson Humanitarian Award. And so.
Okay.
You don't think that a professional tennis player can get out there and do something like that. But it's, that's something that I'm very honored because, as we know, Jackie Robinson's history of what an athlete, but what a humanitarian he was. And so when I was given the award, they told me that I had to demonstrate a concern for mankind and have dedication and personal sacrifice. And so that, you know, when you don't do any, like I didn't do anything to get an award or rewards, but because you had a guest coming up next, and obviously this is when you're on, you know, Sports Talk New York is sports. So
yeah.
I wanted to mention that, you know, baseball, that's my little bit of baseball history is receiving that award. But yeah, so I'm devoting to helping kids and doing what I can and have loved doing it from day one.
Now, some of your former colleagues have joined you in the initiative, haven't they?
Absolutely. John Macer, a famous New Yorker, he was the first person ever to donate. And he's
from Douglaston.
I mean, yeah, he's unbelievable. And he went to people. I was his assistant one year. I asked him if I could be his assistant at the French Open when he was commentating. And I said, look, I'll work all day, all night. I'll get you coffee. I'll get you stats, whatever it is. I'll help you, but if I can go, I can try to talk to some players about the foundation, see if they can help and donate, because, you know, we really do. He let me be his assistant, and he went to Sampras and Agassi and Courier and all the guy players, and he said, look, you got to help her out. You know, she's
yeah.
working so hard. She's here, like, for no money, being my assistant, and she's devoted to helping these kids, so... All those guys stepped in, which was awesome, and we, you know, it's been something where, you know, when you grow up in sports, you feel like you're part of something pretty amazing. And it, as an individual sport, it's very different. It's not a team sport. You don't have necessarily a city or a team behind you, but you still have fans around the world, and there's still people to this day that have known me from tennis that help Little Star, and so it's. I'm pretty grateful for that, and I play the last couple of years. Obviously, Wimbledon hasn't had the Legends because of COVID, but the last time they had the Legends event, I played in the Wimbledon Legends and donated my prize money, and I got Betsy Nagelson, who was also a player in my era. She matched it and found other people to match it. So it still is something special when people can come together.
Is there a website people can go to, Andrea, to check this out?
Sure. It's www.littlestar.org.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, the things you're doing now, Andrea, are probably more important than winning on the hallowed courts of Wimbledon or the clay at Roland Garros. I just want to ask you quickly, do you know who Roland Garros was?
Actually, I do, and they also did they did a special on the history of the French. You know, when you look at history now, like what happened with Naomi Osaka at the French Open, there's the players, incredible tennis the whole time, but I hope everyone remembers that we want to send out, support and just faith that everyone can come together and make the environment a great environment for everyone, not just the people who can handle things easily, but maybe some that are struggling, they can use the support. A lot of people think that Naomi's representing their mm-hmm. voice, kind of how, like, I represent kids' voices that are hurting and suffering. You know, hopefully, a lot of fans will still support her over time, and hopefully we'll see her again soon
Hopefully so, yes. Well, Andrea Yeager, thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend some of it with us up here on Long Island, and I thank you again for coming by.
Okay, thanks so much. Have a great night.
That's Andrea Yeager, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, Bob Kendrick. So stay with us, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back with Sports Talk New York here on WGBB from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island. Islanders, nice win today, 2-1 in their semifinal match with the Bolts from Tampa Bay. The Mets, well, let's just keep talking, folks. Let's keep the sports memories rolling because the Mets didn't make any for us today. Our next guest, he's president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. It's a real pleasure to welcome in tonight Bob Kendrick. Bob, good evening.
Hey, Bill. It's great to be on the show, man. Thanks for having me.
No worries. No worries, Bob. Now, I want to start off by telling you I just spoke to Andrea Yeager, the great tennis player, and she told me that she heard that you were on next, and she told me she won the Jackie Robinson Award from the museum one year. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. Not too bad. So we're tying in all our guests together here, which is a great thing tonight. Now, Bob, please tell the folks why the museum chose Kansas City as its home.
Because Kansas City is the birthplace of the Negro Leagues.
Okay.
The leagues were formed in Kansas City. As a matter of fact, just right around the corner from where we currently operate, the Facile YMCA. That is mm-hmm. where Andrew Rupe Foster
Rupe
led
Foster,
a group of
yeah.
eight independent black baseball team owners into a meeting that was held at the Facile YMCA, and of course, out of that meeting, the birth of the Negro National League, the first successful organized black baseball league. And so we built this museum literally a block and a half away from where the Negro Leagues were formed. And so that is, and we get that question a lot, why mm-hmm. Kansas City? And it's because Kansas City is the birthplace of the founding of the Negro League.
Well, there we go, folks. There's your answer. And a good one from Bob Kendrick. I just want to ask you, Bob, up the block from my house is Argyle Lake, and there was the Argyle Hotel on that site many, many years ago. And the staff of that hotel comprised the Cuban Giants with Saul White. And are you, a lot of people don't know about that.
No, because, you know, it's the early era of black baseball
yeah.
kind of gets diminished some because, again, the contemporaries who have kind of helped bring Negro Leagues mainstream, the Buck O'Neills of the world, the Monty Irvins of the world,
mm-hmm.
they gave us what they saw in the 30s and 40s of the Negro Leagues. And so those who were part of that, you know, storied history of the early era of black baseball, everybody's gone. And so you don't hear too much talk about that. But, you know, we obviously at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, we look at the early era of black baseball as well as the professional Negro Leagues themselves to tell the complete story.
Understood. Okay. Now, tell us a little bit, Bob, about how the museum began. Who was the real spark plug in the initiative?
Buck O'Neill.
Okay.
The legendary John Jordan mm-hmm. Buck O'Neill is the founder of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. It started in a little tiny one-room office across the street from where the museum currently operates inside the historic Lincoln Building. And Buck and other local Negro Leaguers who were still with us at that time, that say they've all passed on now, they literally took turns paying the monthly rent to keep that office open. And with it, our dreams of one day building a facility that would pay rightful tribute to not only one of the greatest chapters in baseball history, but what now thousands of visitors each and every year discover, one of the most amazing chapters in American history, and that's the rich, compelling, inspirational story of the Negro Leagues.
Right, rightfully so, Bob. Definitely. Bob Kendrick with us tonight. He's the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. Now, you're big into education at the museum. You have some great programs. And as you say, you want people to learn about these teams and these guys, what they were up against. And tell us a little bit, Bob, about the education and the programs run by the museum.
You know, we take great pride in the fact that the museum itself is an educational resource,
mm-hmm.
but then we've started to create extensions of the museum by creating educational outreach programs primarily targeted at young audiences, but also their adult programs as well. And we've created programs like Project Retrace, which uses art to help kids understand the history of the Negro Leagues, or Reading Around the Bases, our literacy program, where we bring young people into the museum and they read from select Negro League themed titles with celebrities who read to them, and they're provided books and, you know, we're planting the seed about the importance of literacy while also introducing them to the history of the Negro Leagues. And so there are various kinds of programs that we do, and we're really proud of that because, again, what we wanted, I think, is really important as we, in particularly, introduce this history to our young audience. It is helping them early on understand the importance of diversity, inclusion, equity, tolerance, and respect through the lens of these courageous athletes who, when it was all said and done, just wanted to play ball. They had no idea they were making history. They didn't care about making history. They just wanted to play ball, and they were pretty doggone good at it.
That's true.
But in the process, it really does expand, I think, their horizons and hopefully shape their outlook in a different way in which they will value people for who they are and not what they look like.
What I found interesting, Bob, was the initiative, the program that you call Storied. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yes. Well, and I wish I could tell you it was my idea, but I'd be lying to you. I could tell you, but I'd be lying to you. You know, a local firm here named ProAthlete approached me about this idea to do a digital content series called Storied. And they said, well, Bob, we think you're a pretty good storyteller. We would love to just come to the museum, sit you down, turn the camera on, and have you start telling stories, and then they put it together, put these short vignettes together, and we did 22 stories in 22 weeks on the history of the Negro Leagues. And, you know, this was released right as the pandemic was kind of in full swing, and so people really started to look forward to seeing these each and every week. And we literally did. We sat down over, I don't know, maybe 2.5 hours, and I just recorded these, you know, unscripted, and we just told these stories, and they and ProAthlete did a wonderful job of creating these vignettes, and so it was a lot of fun to do. And now most recently, I'm engaged and involved with a national podcast with SiriusXM Radio called Black Diamonds. And it's the same kind of concept, but, you know, in a long-form fashion, where we tell these untold stories about the history of the Negro Leagues, and this podcast is doing extraordinarily well. We debuted it in April of this year for Jackie Robinson Day, and we talked about why Jackie Robinson, as we like to say, was the chosen one to walk on the moon, because his breaking of the color barrier was equivalent in the African-American community to the first man to walk on the moon. And so we just finished season one of this. The next episode will complete series one, which will be a look at Larry Doby, who I guess you could say was the Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah, correct. Good one, Bob. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, and so, you know, if you enjoy podcasts, please check it out. It's available anywhere where you download your podcast, and it has picked up a lot of momentum and is doing extraordinarily well. My friends over at SiriusXM, they are doing a tremendous job of producing these, and so folks are falling in love with this new podcast called Black Diamonds.
And I just want to mention to the folks who may not know, and I'm sure you've spoken to this gentleman, the passing this week of Jim Mudcat Grant, who was one of the Black Aces, from as we call them. There was a book about them. Did you work with Mudcat at all, Bob?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mudcat was a dear friend. And so, needless to say, even though I knew that his health was failing, it is still a very sad day when I got the news of his passing. And he spent many, many a times here in Kansas City at various Negro League Baseball Museum events. As a matter of fact, you'll hear his voice in this next episode of Black Diamonds because he was Larry Doby's roommate. He talks about being Larry Doby's roommate when Mudcat joined the Cleveland Indians. And so it's a hilarious story that his voice will be part of the next episode of Black Diamonds. But, yeah, I'm deeply saddened by his passing. you know, his group, the Black Aces. We recently did a podcast where I had CeCe Sabathia and David Price and the great Dave Stewart, and that podcast was dedicated to Mudcat Grant before he passed away, because it was about the Black Aces, but also about Negro League pitchers who would have been 20 game winners in the major leagues had they been given the opportunity. And Mud writes about them in that beautiful book known as The Black Aces. And of course, there are 15 African-American pitchers to win 20 games in a major league season. And so it is a very rarefied group. He was very proud of this group and still hopeful that there will be others that will enter into this group. So his passing leaves a tremendous void for all of us here at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
Yeah, all these guys that have passed on, they're becoming scarcer and scarcer Negro League ball players, and what a treasure it was to have them and their stories. I remember one time Mudcat told me, Bob, that I think he was in the minor leagues, and he was looking to load up a little bit, and he left soap in his uniform, and as the game went on and the flannel heated up, bubbles started forming on his uniform. So he was. Yeah, I think he was asked to leave at that point. You know?
Yeah, I think he had to make an exit from the game. He always delighted in telling that story, and you know he has some great stories. He told a story of an umpire who seemed to always squeeze him in the strike zone, and so Mudcat and my good friend Joe Askew, former Major League catcher Joe Askew.
I used to have his cards. Yeah, Joe Askew.
Yeah, no, and Joe is still here in Kansas City. So they got together, and the two of them said, they're going to kind of teach this umpire a lesson. And these guys, and I can't even believe that Joe agreed to do this, Joe put horse manure on the back of his catcher's mask. And so as the umpire is leaning over, he's continually smelling his manure, and as Mudcat would, you know, the Cliff Note version of the story, as Mudcat would relate, the strike zone got a little wider, and the game went a whole lot quicker because that umpire was ready to get the heck out of there.
That's a great one. Oh man. What great stories, folks. Jim Mudcat Grant. What a gentleman, as we said, Bob. He'll be missed. Now, we spoke about the late, great Buck O'Neill, who founded the museum, actually. The Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center. Tell us about that, Bob.
Yeah, it's going to be built in the site of the old Paseo YMCA. Mm-hmm. So the very building that the Negro Leagues were formed in 1920, we're in the process of restoring that historic landmark, and we'll convert it into an education and research center in memory of my dear friend, the late, great John Buck O'Neill, and basically go full circle right back to the very building that gave birth to the story we're now charged with preserving. And so it will become an exciting expansion of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So we'll have expanded exhibit opportunities. It will have classroom space. It has an amazing event space where we turned and converted the old gymnasium into one of the most amazing event spaces, certainly here in Kansas City. It will ultimately house an interactive baseball experience built around the math and science of baseball, which we're also very excited about. And then it will have some office space and even some office lease space as we really start to position the museum for its next 30 years of growth. We're now in our 31st year as an organization, and it's been an amazing three decades for a little museum that no one gave any chance of succeeding when we started in that little one-room office. And today we're proudly recognized as America's National Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And so, but you know, I say that understanding that we've only scratched the surface. There's still so much work to be done. There's still so many stories to be told, and then our job is to continually try and find relevant ways to connect this future generation to a story that they've been very much removed from, but the life lessons of the Negro League still plays on today. And that's my job. You know, our job as an institution is to make that relevant connection. But I think any museum, and particularly any history museum, should always be challenging itself on how do we make history relevant to our young people, this mm-hmm. next generation of people, because I think it's falsely assumed that they don't care about history. They do care, but it becomes very important on how it's presented to them. And that's what we're working on now, to make sure that we find creative, innovative ways to present this history to them so that they can relate to it.
What is the website for the museum for the folks out there, Bob?
Yeah, absolutely. It's at www.nlbm.com, and you can learn, you know, what's going on at the museum. If you're so inclined, we would welcome your support of this museum. You can become a member. You can shop in our gift shop if you want some nice gear, you know, representative of the Negro Leagues.
That's what I was going to mention, Bob. I was going to mention to the folks, go to the store on the website. There's the great bobbleheads, caps, jerseys, some wonderful memorabilia of the Negro Leagues, folks. And for the bobblehead collectors out there, and I know you're out there, there's some tremendous ones. I'm looking at the F.M. Manley myself to
yes.
pick up. That outstanding. Just quickly, Bob, we have about a minute. Who are you a fan of?
Oh, man. From the Negro League?
From present day. Who do you root for?
Oh, you know, I'm a lifelong Atlanta Braves fan.
Ah, okay.
Of course, living here in Kansas City, I've got to be a Kansas City Royal fan.
Uh-huh.
Because, number one, they are a tremendous supporter of the Negro League Baseball Museum. But I grew up in Georgia, so I'm a lifelong Braves fan, and then I converted to a Kansas City Royal fan. Thankfully, they're in two different leagues, so I can pull for both of them.
Well, they don the uniforms of the Monarchs once in a while, don't they, the Royals?
They do.
Yeah.
We just had one in May, our salute to the Negro Leagues, and then they're so generous, they auction off those uniforms. This year was the Royals against the Detroit Tigers, or the Kansas City Monarchs against the Detroit Stars.
Stars,
and
right.
And both
yeah.
teams, you know, the players, the game-worn uniforms were autographed by the players, and they're being auctioned with all the proceeds coming back to benefit the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So, you know, it's always a special day to
yeah.
see the young athlete wearing those uniforms, and particularly when they wear those pants up high to show the socks,
yeah.
you know, and a little bit baggy the way they wore them in the Negro League.
The way it's supposed to be, Bob. Yes, I agree with you. Stirrups all the way. Now, Bob Kendrick, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to hang with us up here on Long Island, and we wish you nothing but the best for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City. And folks, as we said, if you're in the area, stop in, because it's a tremendous place and they'd love to have you. Thanks again, Bob.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
That's Bob Kendrick, folks. Well, we'll be right back to you. Former Yankees trainer Jeff Mangold. Hang with us, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for?
Visit GusBuster.com and get your GusBuster today.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we are back. We are back with Sports Talk New York on GBB. Let's carry on. Our next guest, he served as the head strength and conditioning coach for the Yankees from 1984 to 1988 and again from 1998 to 2006. During his tenure, the team won 9 straight American League East titles, appeared in 5 World Series, and won 3 World Series titles, of course, 98, 99, and 2000 when they stole the series from the Mets. The Mets should have won that series, we all know. Mangold also worked for the New York Mets. There you go. So he was away from the dark side for a while. And he had a design on both the Yankee and the Shea Stadium training and coaching facilities. He's now an author. Latest book, Power and Pinstripes, My Years Training the New York Yankees. It's the book is from our friends out in Chicago, Triumph Books. I welcome in tonight Jeff Mangold. Jeff, good evening.
Bill, hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Let's get to it. The foreword of the book is by the great Mariano Rivera.
I must have caught him on a good day. it was just very gracious of Mariano to step forward and no pun intended there, but to do the foreword for me. And also, I must mention Peter Boddy, the Long Island native, still out there that co-authored the book with me, and he did a tremendous job. But definitely very powerful beginning to it all with Mariano.
Certainly. Wonderful way to start it off, Jeff. Now, I just wanted to ask you before we get into the book, why are today's players getting hurt the way they are? I mean, years ago, when I was a kid, you never heard of an oblique injury or something like that. Why are these things happening today?
If I had the answer to that, I'd be like Jack Brown and have toes in the water and my you-know-what in the sand.
Yeah.
Sitting along the beach. But part of it, one of the ingredients, has got to be the amount of torque that these players have of generating so much force, and that the tendons and ligaments, after a while, cannot handle the acceleration and also the deceleration of a swing, of a throw, and also to run. And I do not know definitely what teams are doing, because I am not in the weight room to see what type of programming is going on. So I really can't throw somebody under the bus, you might say, but it is very strange. It's too bad. Every day there's new headlines. Another 10-day spin on the injured.
Another guy down. Yeah.
Yeah, just
not good. Yeah, let's get right to the book now. You talk about the boss, and a lot of people, maybe the younger Yankee fans, don't even remember George Steinbrenner. But it just so happens, Jeff, that every former Yankee that I speak with has nothing but great things to say about George.
Well, because he cares, and he cared about the ultimate goal of being the last team standing, and that he would fight for you. He would to put a team together, but also individually, especially if you were to meet with him one-on-one. I think his personality might change a little bit when it's one-on-one, as the case with quite a few people, but you know where he stood. There's no gray area. There's no being on the fence. This is how it's going to be. And either you get it done or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's good to be pushed, and darn right he pushed.
The boss, yeah. Look him up, kids. You'll find out a lot about George Steinbrenner. One guy we'll lead into from that conversation is Billy Martin. Let's talk about Billy.
Yeah, the first time I met Billy was when he took over for Yogi in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And when he probably took about 4 or 5 days before I met him, even though Billy was managing the team. And that, I guess one story about him, because we only have so much time, but this was after the fight in Texas.
Oh,
where
yeah.
The supposed fights where he got trapped in the laboratory. He got beat up by a few guys. But the next day he comes to the ballpark and he has about 30 or 40 stitches in his ear.
Oh.
And he comes up to me and goes, "Mangold, today, your job." Because it was the weekend game of the week. Because back then there were, all the games weren't televised as they are. He says, "I want you to stand in front of the camera that's zooming in on the dugout. I want you to block that camera. You got me?" So here's Billy, conscious of, doesn't want to be, have the whole nation to be zeroing in on his activities or his stitches and so forth. But
the great Billy Martin, folks, yeah. He's resting in peace in Gate of Heaven Cemetery, just a few feet from Babe Ruth. You guys can go up and visit him, pay your respects. Let's talk about the Roger Clemens, Mike Piazza broken bat. I know you're going to give me the Yankee viewpoint on this, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yeah, that with Roger, he would just get so amped up prior to a game, and because I would be privy to that, he'd be in the weight room probably 45 minutes, 40 minutes before the game, and before he would go out to the bullpen to warm up to get ready to go. But he'd be in the weight room and have his own choice of music. You knew what he had. As soon as he started walking down the hallway, you'd get his music on for him to get him riled, get him rocking and rolling. Mm-hmm. And by the time he came out of the weight room, he's all sweaty and soft and ready to go. So he's in that, I think it was the first inning anyway where it happened, that, you know, with their previous encounters that they've had, there was some bad blood there, and I don't know what he thought, if that was the ball coming back at him, the barrel of the bat, and that he was either upset at Piazza or also just to get this barrel of the bat out of here.
But yeah,
that was just a strange situation.
It didn't look good for Roger, even as a Met fan, that doesn't look good. Yeah.
no, not at all. It's like, what? And then things came to a halt right there. It was never taken any further. You know, no benches clearing or anything. But I think the fans will be very interested to read and find out of whatever happened to that barrel of the bat.
Ah, there's a little teaser, folks. Find out about Piazza, his Mizuno bat. I mean, that's what he uses at the plate, Mizuno.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And definitely for the authentication of the cleat marks from him, because Piazza would always, he'd step out after every pitch and he would slap his left foot and then his right foot, and just to get the mud off of his cleat, just one of their superstitions or rhythm approaches to hitting. And sure enough, that was on the barrel of the bat, that's for sure.
Well, folks, if you want to see, if you never saw Mike Piazza play, and you want to see him at the plate, what his mannerisms were, just Google Robin Ventura during a rain delay imitating Mike Piazza. And have you seen that, Jeff?
No, I don't.
Yeah, check that out. He runs the bases and everything. Ventura was a scream. He had everybody up on the top step, but
He probably didn't run it too fast. But I tell you what, though, when I think of Piazza and that fly ball that he hit in, what was it, Game 5 in the Subway Series, to end that series, I mean, every time Piazza comes up to the plate, that you're just, he's beyond a threat to go deep. And as you well know, right center, right field, left center, dead center, it didn't matter. And he just missed that pitch. I mean, that ball would have been gone. I think everybody thought it was gone, too, but it just settled down to Bernie out there at the shore of the warning track in left center.
Yeah, Mike Piazza, folks. That's a story for another day. How did you get from the Yankees to the Mets, Jeff?
Well, I would say it would be the connection with Jeff Torborg, who was manager.
Ah, okay.
I think he took over in 93, but Torborg was the bullpen coach for the Yankees back in the 80s, so we developed a relationship, and that there was an opening for that position with the Mets, and because in 1988 I got the boot from Steinbrenner, which which happens. And so that gave me the opportunity when the stars aligned to be one of those coaches slash players that donned both uniforms, Mets and Yankees. Mm-hmm. So it was a lucky time for me to be able to work for both teams in New York City. So growing up in Sioux City, Iowa, to end up in New York City.
Not bad, not bad. You mentioned Jeff Torborg, kind of a chill goes down my spine. Because they weren't such memorable days back then as they were supposed to be when they brought him in. Now, do you have rings from all these World Series, Jeff?
Yes, I do.
Nice, yeah.
Very, very lucky.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So what do you have? What hardware do you have? Give us an idea.
And the thing is, they're not too gaudy. You see some Super Bowl rings, and you see some NBA championships.
Oh, like that Marlins ring from about 10 years ago when they won, or whatever it was. It's like it's like a soda can on your finger. You know, it's
yeah. I think it could dislocate somebody's shoulder.
Yeah,
wear it so long.
That's right.
But no, I'm lucky enough to have 3 world championship rings and 9 divisional American League championship rings and. Couple of mementos from the perfect game of David Cohn.
Oh boy, that's
David
great.
Wells.
Yeah, not too bad. You did good, Jeff.
Yeah. So with a quick story, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
After Boomer's perfect game, that he had some rings made out and given to the team after about two months after his perfect game, which was just hair-raising experience to be at the stadium for that. Just such adrenaline flow. But with Coney, that he and I had a relationship where he told me up front, he said, Mangold, I'm going to ride you hard because the team likes David Cone's humor, and he likes to get on people. And he says, I know you can handle it because you give it back to me as much as I give it to you. So here we are with Cone had his a watch ceremony, very prestigious, very nice watch, just made up. And he's giving out watches, and we're in a clubhouse and all set up, and Tino Martinez, come on forward, here's your watch, here, Paul O'Neill, Polly, come on up. And it gets to Jeff Mangold, and he goes, I can't believe I'm giving you a damn watch. I can't believe this. So it never ended.
Oh man, David Cohn, folks, yeah. And another character to look up. A great pitcher, a great hired gun for a lot of teams out there.
Yeah, with character with a capital C, that's for sure.
Yeah,
we
had him on the program when he did his book, and he's very entertaining. Now, one chapter I found interesting, Jeff Mangold, with his former trainer of the Yankees, your encounter with some celebs.
Yeah, one was. Billy Crystal. This was in 2001 in the Arizona Diamondbacks for the World Series. We're a day before the opening game at the stadium. Beautiful day, Yankee Stadium. I have the team out in right center field, and they're circled around me to warm up and to stretch and to get loose prior to practice. Well, Joe Torre's is a good friend with Billy Crystal, and so Billy would come around to the clubhouse every once in a while, and so that day he dressed out in Yankee pinstripes, and as I said, I'm out in the right center field, bright sunshine, and all of a sudden Billy Crystal comes kind of slowly jogging out, walking out towards us. So it just kind of dawned on me to go. I just gave a yell to Billy Crystal, like to mimic City Slickers. I said, get your urine out here. I said, I am your worst nightmare. Get out here. But I'm trying to remember the guy that was on the trail boss that was on the horse. And sure enough, Billy Crystal goes from a little trot to like a full sprint, like, oh my God, I better get going.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty good. Folks, this and more you'll find in Power and Pinstripes, My Years Training the New York Yankees. Jeff Mangold, thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us here on Long Island. Again, folks, Power and Pinstripes, My Years Training the New York Yankees, from our buddies out in Chicago, Triumph Books. Thanks again, Jeff. All the best to you.
Bill, thank you, too. Thank you, and continued success.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jeff. Take care. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, Andrea Yeager, Bob Kendrick, and Jeff Mangold, and my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you for joining us. Pete and Faz up next. Stick around till we meet again. Be safe. Be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
This is WGBB AM 1240 and W240 DF FM 95.9 Freeport, New York.